From the Lynn de Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 7th day of January 2025. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Greg Johnson, the weather forecast with Drew Lerner, and we'll hear from Jordan Fife, who is with BioUrgia. We talk with him from time to time. They own the ethanol plant in Peoria, but he also is centered in Houston, right there in the energy sector, and has worked extensively in that area. We'll talk with him about Venezuela and crude oil from there and how it might be processed here in the United States on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
March corn for the day settled at $4.46¾, up 2¾. December at $4.63¾, up 2. And March beans, 10¾ higher, at $10.67. The November new crop at $10.75¼, up 7½ cents on this Wednesday afternoon. Greg Johnson from TGM, TotalGrainMarketing.com, now joins us to take a look at the marketplace. Hi, Greg. Thanks for joining us again on a Wednesday. It's been a fairly good week, particularly for soybeans. I guess China's been back in the market, and sometimes the market's happy, sometimes it is, well, we already knew that, and happy again today. Were there more sales or something else happened?
No, that's exactly what it is. The sales have a lot of people thinking that China has now fulfilled 10 million metric tons of the 12 million metric ton commitment that that they supposedly agreed to, even though we haven't seen the actual agreement yet. But every time there's another sale announced, that gets us a little bit closer to the 12 million. So, you know, people have always asking, is that good or bad if China buys 12? And I always say, well, 12 is better than zero, but you have to remember that in previous years, they bought as many as 23 to 25 million metric tons of soybeans from the U.S. So we're still not back to where we were, but obviously it's better than zero.
It is better than zero. I do have a question about that 10 billion. Is it that they have made new purchases, or does that count something from the beginning of the marketing year?
Well, that's a good question. I think this counts for the marketing year, which started September 1, September 1. So the question is, once they fulfill the 12 million ton quota or agree for the agreement, when does the 23.5 million metric ton quota start? Is that a calendar year, or is that a marketing year? And does the marketing year not start until the fall of 26, or is that a calendar year where they have to buy those by the end of 26? Because, you know, you would think that the 12 million, they're getting, you know, they have to buy that by the end of February. Chances are they'll get that done. They're well on their way, 10 out of 12. But then the South American crop comes online March forward, and you would think that China is going to be buying most of their beans needs from South America for the next 6 or 7 months. So that kind of takes us out of the market until this fall. And depending on how many beans South America has, it doesn't look very likely to me that we will be exporting many beans to China during the spring and summer months. And so then, you know, it's kind of critical that we start back up again in the fall. So I guess I think it's a crop year thing that probably won't start until September of 26.
It also might be interesting to see how China reacts to the Trump administration's playing in the Venezuelan oil fields. China is its primary export marketplace. I suspect that they might not be very happy about that, and it could have an impact, I suppose, on trade in the coming year as well. We'll have to wait and see what that looks like. In the corn market, what have you been watching this week?
Corn market just continues to stay in that 30-cent trading range. The good news is we're back to the midpoint. We were down at the bottom of the range. Now we're in the middle of the range, so that's good. We do have a USDA report, the all-important January report comes out Monday at 11. Traders are hoping, expecting USDA to lower that corn yield. Some people buy as many as 4 or 5 bushels to the acre. And I was just doing some back of the napkin figuring. A 4-bushel drop would translate to about 380 million bushels. If they lower the feed usage by a couple hundred million from 6.1 billion to 5.9, that would offset 200 of that 380 drop. So we could see a net drop of maybe 180 million bushels, which sounds good. But keep in mind that just gets your carry out from 2.1 down to 1.9 or 1.85. So we're not going to run out of corn. It makes the ending stocks table look a little tighter, but 1.85 is still plenty of corn. And so I guess I'm still in the camp. If we do get a friendly report, that might be a selling opportunity, not the beginning of the next bull market.
In Friday morning, the U.S. Supreme Court will deliver some opinions. It's not clear that there will be an opinion delivered about tariffs. It is possible. We'll be able to talk about that Friday afternoon. It could have an impact on the World Ag supply and demand estimates. It's related to exports, I suppose, too.
Oh, yeah. You talk about causing chaos and confusion. If the Supreme Court would rule it that the Trump tariffs are not constitutional, where do we go from there? Do we have to renegotiate all these individual trade deals? Do we have to give back money? Oh my gosh, yes. Some people are saying that the Supreme Court may kind of allow it to tell them that they're not legal, but we'll let you keep what you've done, just because it would be so confusing to try to, you know, rectify what's already been done. So yeah, I think a lot of people are going to be, you know, interested in what the Supreme Court decides, whenever they decide that later this week or next week.
A couple of big things to watch. Thank you for helping us pay attention to both the U.S. Supreme Court and the World Ag Supply Demand Estimates. The final crop production numbers, those are due out Friday and Monday, respectively. We'll talk with you again next Wednesday.
Sounds good. Thanks, Todd.
Greg Johnson is with TGM. That's TotalGrainMarketing.com. You all may remember that we have talked to Jordan Fife of BioErgia. He's the president of BioErgia Trading, actually, out of Houston, Texas. We've done that from time to time over the years. That company, BioErgia itself, owns some interesting assets, including an ethanol plant there in Peoria, Illinois, and a couple of other things. Jordan is based in Houston, and as it happens, Jordan, you're right in the middle of the energy sector with your neighbors in the office buildings, I suppose, being Chevron and Conoco and BP and a whole bunch of other places?
That's correct.
So I'm going to guess that the last 3 days when you've been out just at the local pub or eating lunch, that there has been a lot of interesting conversation. I want to talk with you about Venezuela and the oil that is produced there to begin with, and then to maybe get some insights from you as it's related to what the consequences might be or the future, either one. Let's begin with the kind of crude oil that comes out of those Venezuela fields. It is heavy sour as opposed to sweet light. What are the differences?
That's a great question. Thanks always for having me, Todd. Happy to speak about this topic. So Venezuela has, as you alluded to, a heavy sour crude. That means it's dense. That means in the industry, a lot of people call it roots and rocks. It's harder to extract. It's much, much denser, and its application is different than a light sweet. Light sweet is what we have here in America, and that's what we're running through our Gulf Coast refineries right now. And our Gulf Coast refineries, just for your edification, is running at about a 95% efficiency. So that's about as much as you can run a refinery right now. That's the pedal to the metal, the floor is to the ground. That will be important a little bit later on in this conversation, but put a little bookmark on that. So we're running a light sweet through, much easier to extract. The application for light sweet is much more on the gasoline side. It's a lighter end. So you're producing a lot of lighter end products out of it. When you use a heavy sour, like a Venezuelan crude, you'll produce more asphalt, you'll produce more diesel. But there is a complication that I don't know if a lot of people know about with Venezuelan crude. It is so dense that you actually have to add what's called diluent to it to make it liquid enough to go on to a vessel to export it. So you have to add something that thins out the crude once you extract it from the ground. That is not the case with a light sweet crude. A light sweet crude is very liquid. And it's also a very different color. If you've never seen it, it sometimes is a yellow, sometimes it's a green. Most people think all crude is black because they call it black gold. The dense stuff is very black, but the light sweet is actually a different color, and it's not nearly as viscous. So one, just for everybody, you have to add this stuff called diluent to put it onto a boat or to put it into a pipeline or anything like that. So that is something that has to be imported. Diluent comes from natural gas processing. The most of the diluent that we get in the United States comes from Canada, because Canada also produces a heavy slate. Their tar sands are heavy, not as heavy as Venezuela, but it's something that is much more close to that than what we produce here in the United States. In addition to it being extremely viscous, the Venezuelan crude, it is also higher in sulfur. So you have to treat that. And there's a lot of refineries that are not set up to do so. So I'll pause there. And if there's any questions you'd like to ask around that, if not, I can kind of go into the configurations of the Gulf Coast refinery versus the Midwest refinery here in the United States, and then the impacts that this could have on the oil industry in large.
That was my next question, was the difference between the configurations and what this might mean in the United States. Because here in the Midwest, we do have refineries, but they certainly are configured differently than those that you have along the Gulf Coast. Tell me about that.
Absolutely. The Midwest refineries are actually more suited to take Venezuelan crude, because the Midwestern refineries, and let's call it Joliet in Illinois or BP Whiting in Indiana, or your refineries in Michigan, or the Dakotas even, they're taking in a lot of Canadian crude. And that Canadian crude, as we just discussed earlier, is a heavier crude. So they, again, once again, add diluent and everything like that to it to thin it out a little bit. Maybe they'll blend it a little bit with a little bit of light sweet. But those refineries in the Midwest are more capable of taking a heavy crude. The refineries, and I alluded to this earlier, that are running at 95% in the Gulf, they're taking in a little bit of heavy crude, but for the most part, they're running a light sweet crude through their slate right now. If you took in all of the Venezuelan crude and then stopped taking the light sweet to our refineries in the Gulf Coast, you'd have to play some shell game to reconfigure everything. And as I said, since we're running at 95% capacity, it's not like there's extra capacity out there to run it. So it's a very interesting idea. You know, we're hearing the news and everybody like that saying, oh, we're just going to bring in all this because the refineries can take it. Well, they've got contracts in place, you know, for crude they've already bought well throughout the year. So you can't just displace those barrels and not take them. Again, they've configured these Gulf Coast refineries to take more light sweet, and they're profitable. The last thing, you know, is these oil refining companies are extremely profitable right now. Do they want to overturn the apple cart on something that might not be there in 2 years? That's kind of these are the next questions we start to ask ourselves. How long does this last? What kind of government guarantees do we have? And that hasn't even touched on the fact that the Venezuelan oil infrastructure needs billions and billions and billions of dollars to get it back to its heyday. And would that cut off the oil industry's nose to spite their face, because they have invested billions and billions of dollars in United States oil extraction that's going very well? So I think there's a lot of people's expectations that we're just going to, the United States as we'll just start taking all this Venezuelan crude into the Gulf Coast. Well, one, it's really not set up to do it right now. Two, the refineries are running at a high rate of efficiency, so there's not excess capacity to take extra crude. And three, the real refineries that should be taking more heavy crude are the Midwestern refineries, as we've discussed, but they've got contracts with Canada. So the displacement of crude really would come from more heavy, you know, brothers in arms, if you will, long term, which would be Canada. I don't know how it's going to play out, and frankly, I don't believe anyone does. But I can tell you right now, we have not increased the global oil production overnight. All we have done is just reshell gamed where crude could potentially go. I don't think it's a long term solution. It would have to be a very long term solution. So I should guess a more short term solution that we're going to have this flood of Venezuelan crude into the Gulf to be processed and then sent back out. I think it would make more sense to resell the oil to West Africa or to China or to someone like that. We frankly don't need it just yet. And I don't know how you would get it to the mid-con refineries that are more set up to take it. Again, we've discussed you need to put diluent into it to make it more liquid, less viscous. You'd have to maybe ship it up the Mississippi River. These are all expensive and non-preferred logistics. It's not a slam dunk. It's not a home run. It's not like we just found something that will automatically be processed, is I guess what I'm trying to convey.
So you, in a former life, worked for Racetrack Petroleum for 5 years in various positions, including as their transportation analyst, pipe and waterborne scheduler as well. Do you see a way that things could be reconfigured longer term that would possibly displace Canadian crude coming into the Midwest? And I think mostly, is it piped in or is it coming in by rail?
The Canadian crude is piped and rail. Crude by rail has decreased over time, but that used to be the kind of in vogue way to do it. The company I work for, BioRosa, actually used to own, we have sold it since, a North Dakota crude by rail facility. And by the end of the asset's life under BioRosa, before we sold it, it was mainly doing frac sand. And so crude by rail has almost, it hasn't evaporated, but it has decreased 90% since we've found ways to extract heavy Canadian tar sands. Most of that is being moved by pipe. But there is some truck, there is some rail, no doubt. But long term, absolutely, things could be displaced. But most of the time, and you know, let's take this back to like an agricultural analogy. You change your behaviors when things are no longer profitable. Right now, these companies are profitable in doing what they're doing. So to change it just because, and I'm not just saying, you know, I'm picking on Trump or anything like that, but just because Trump has done something, and it's like, well, now you need to do this. There's a lot of hesitation. And you know, rewind the tape. Oil companies were in Venezuela. Venezuela was nationalized, and they created PDVSA under Chavez, and then obviously went to Maduro. But these oil companies are, you know, once bitten, twice shy, right? Would you go back to somewhere that you used to operate in that your assets were nationalized by a dictator? You would need a lot of assurances to do that. And the infrastructure, and, you know, you've probably heard a lot about that. The infrastructure has been decimated over the years of neglect in Venezuela. But on top of that, their best engineers and everyone like that fled Venezuela. And a lot of them live in Houston. My old neighbor was a petroleum engineer from Venezuela, and he could not go back home. He can now, so that's a win. They've lost a lot of expertise, and they've lost a lot of infrastructure. It would take a lot of money in addition to assurances that this would not occur again for it to really start displacing. Right now, it's a holding pattern. Everybody's waiting to see what's next. You know, the oil companies are visiting the White House. There's talk of hedge funds. I think Trafigura is going down to Venezuela to meet both with the United States side and current Venezuelan representatives. People are lining up and getting pole position. But I think it's much more of a, we want to hear what you have to say before we start investing money, because it will be tens and tens of billions of dollars and years of hard work. You guys have probably seen the facts and figures. They're extracting a small amount of the oil that they need right now. Ultimately, it will come down to if it's economically viable or not. And from what I've read from multiple reports, it takes between $60 and $70 per barrel for new Venezuelan production to come online. And right now, right before I came in here, oil was sitting right around $55. I know everybody wants cheap gasoline. Everybody wants cheap distillates. You know, I'm in that camp. But if you look at inflation and to other commodities, rare earth specifically, and then you compare it to the inflation we've had in oil, $55 to $60 crude oil is pretty cheap, to be perfectly honest. I know that's hard for some to hear, but it's actually pretty cheap. And I don't think the oil companies are going to continue to explore and flood the market, knowing that, you know, a lot of the shale production starts coming offline at sub $50 crude. So increases in one is going to push down another, in my mind. And to answer your question, sure, you could start displacing and moving stuff around, but it's going to be years. I don't think it happens overnight. I've been wrong before. I'm going to be wrong again. I feel pretty confident in that statement.
Hey, thanks much. I appreciate it, Jordan.
Anytime. Thanks, Todd.
Mm-hmm. Jordan Fife is with BioRosa Trading, where he's the president. Thanks to him for joining us here on the Closing Market Report. Now let's turn our attention to the weather forecast. Drew Lerner joins us from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Hi, Drew. Thanks for being with us. Let's get right to it. Start here in the United States. Things warmed up a lot. I'm wondering how the hard red winter wheat growing regions are faring and what issues you might see them facing in the future.
Yeah, you know, probably the most important thing with the wheat is the fact that it's been dry. That's actually the saving grace, I think, in this situation. I say that because it has been so warm. The soil temperatures are definitely supportive of wheat development if we had moisture in the ground for Oklahoma and Texas and even the Delta. And we've had some pretty impressive days. I think last Sunday afternoon, we had highs in western Kansas reaching 79 degrees, which is hard to believe. But nonetheless, winter hardiness has certainly been reduced or removed in a lot of places. But we are warm enough in Oklahoma and Texas for crop development. But it is so dry that that development is pretty much on hold. We still have reduced hours of daylight, obviously, and some cooling at night, but it's real important that we get back on track here and bring in some colder weather and not let it rain while we're still warm. I think that is so important. If we get a good rain in these areas and it stays warmer than normal, then we're going to really stir up some crop development, and I think that's going to set the stage for a problem later. So that, I think, needs to be closely monitored. We do have a low-pressure center that will occur tonight coming out of the southwestern United States and will move through Kansas and very quickly to the Great Lakes region. All that will occur tomorrow during the course of the day. And behind it will be a little stream of rain. And that will probably produce a trace upwards to maybe 3 or 4 tenths of an inch in hard ribbon or wheat country. Some greater amounts certainly occurring from eastern Kansas outside of wheat areas through Iowa and into Wisconsin. We're going to see some 1 inch plus amounts of rain in that corridor. So that'll be good for them down the road. But again, it's not so good for putting moisture in the soil in wheat areas. Now, we are going to cool it down, though, and we're going to actually stir up a second storm system that'll occur Friday, and it will generate snow in Colorado and areas southward into the northern Texas panhandle and southwestern Kansas. So we'll see a small area there that will come up with some healthier amounts of snow. So that will contribute to the moisture that we're going to get from tonight and tomorrow. So the bottom line is we want to cool it down, and we will cool it down for about 2 days, and then we'll turn around and bring some warmer air back into the plain. So again, I just kind of encourage a little closer watch on the southern plains as we go forward through the second half of winter. I don't want to advocate a big problem or anything, but things could get out of hand if we don't get more consistent cool weather.
Speaking of problems, and I don't want to talk about Brazil because I don't think there's a problem there, but in Argentina, it's kind of, do they or do they not have an issue that is developing? What can you tell me?
Yeah, you know, last week we saw temperatures in the 90s to over 100 degrees in La Pampa and Buenos Aires and some neighboring areas in San Luis and Cordoba. And that southwest corner of Argentina has been dry for a good couple of weeks now, and they do need some rain. Now, I'd say dry. They've had a few showers, but it's been well below normal. And with the heat last week, it really zapped a lot of that moisture out of the soil. So topsoil and subsoil moisture is very limited in La Pampa and San Luis and some areas in southwestern Cordoba, just in that particular area. You get a little bit further to the east and subsoil moisture is still relatively good. And outside of last week's heat, we really haven't had that much hot weather. And we do have a few showers that are occurring today across some of that region. They aren't very impressive, but it's going to add a little buffer for those areas that have subsoil moisture around. Now, this weekend, we're going to see central parts of Argentina come up with some significant rain. And then late next week, we'll finally bring an opportunity for some moisture of significance to perhaps Buenos Aires. So the bottom line here is that, yeah, there's some areas that are hurting, but most of the major grain and oilseed areas have not been seriously impacted thus far. And if we get the showers that are advertised over the next week to week and a half, we will probably stop them from having a real serious issue. But I can't get excited about this having a big long-term impact. And it looks like when we look down the road in weeks 2 and 3, there's an opportunity for some showers and certainly no high-pressure ridge is going to make them hot and dry. So I think for right now, we just kind of need to watch what goes on, not get too excited. This isn't going to be a big deal, I don't think, unless something changes for the second week.
Hey, thanks much, Drew.
You have a great day.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Joined us on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report that came to you from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason.